The Inner Voice, According to the Teachings of the Great Spiritual Masters by C. W. Sanders. Published by Radhaswami Satsang Bias, print copyright 1948 and 2002, and audio recording copyright 2026, Radhaswami Satsang Bias. All rights reserved. Contents. Preface to the 10th edition. Author's preface to the 1st edition. The Inner Voice. The Message of the Masters. The Plan of Creation. How can we recognize a true master? The Temple of God. How to approach and cross the threshold. The sound current or the word. Conditions for initiation. Karma. The proof. Question and answers. Preface to the 10th edition. One of the first Western initiates of a Bias master, Colonel Sanders, wrote this succinct introduction to Santmath in 1948. Half a century later, the book still presents a concise, clear, and relevant overview of the path of Surat Shabad Yoga, the inner path of the word. Particularly since it is a seminal introductory book, it was felt necessary to modernize the language so that archaic words or constructions should not come between the modern reader and the practical message of God realization that the book conveys. All citations, where possible, have been sourced. Where they couldn't be, they have been replaced by new scriptural quotations conveying the same point. Sometimes a more modern translation has been chosen for a quotation from the wider range available today compared to what the author had at his command. Sewa Singh, Secretary, Radhaswami Satsang Bias, January 2000. Author's Preface to the 1st Edition. This book is written primarily for the peoples of the West. It endeavours to summarise the main principles of a science which deals with man and his maker, is as old as creation and as true now as it has always been and always will be. It is a science naturally perfect, which does not undergo change and admits of no modifications, for it is not man-made. It reveals the Creator's design. The history of religions shows us that in the beginning, a religion is a means of communion between man and his Creator, and it continues to serve this purpose so long as there are highly advanced spiritual adepts living here to instruct men. But when the leadership passes into less competent hands, religion deviates from its purpose and degenerates into mere rites and ceremonies. Outward activities take the upper hand and obscure the real purpose of religion. Looked at from this angle, religion may be considered under two headings, esoteric and exoteric. Esoteric religion deals with the spirit, bringing it freedom from mind and matter, now and not in the hereafter, its object being the uplift of the soul and its communion with God in this very life on earth. Exoteric religion aims more at ameliorating the condition and bettering the status of its followers. It insists on the observance of religious duties, singing hymns, saying fervent prayers to please God, in the expectation of a reward in the hereafter. Man has a life of spirit as his background. As the body is enlivened by the existence of soul, and if deprived thereof, it decays and becomes useless. So in the same way, exoteric religion, deprived of a spiritual background, degenerates into bigotry, narrow sectarianism, intolerance and fanaticism, which are the sources of all religious struggles, strife, misery and bloodshed. In spite of his intellectual advancement and keen theological search, modern man has not made much headway in this field. He still gropes in darkness and does not know where to seek the light and how to solve the riddle. The word religion comes from the root re, meaning back, and ligare, meaning to bind, the way which binds our soul back with God. The signs presented here gives a clue to the direction and tells you how and in what manner the inquiry is to be conducted. It is neither a new religion nor even a religion. There is no question of proselytizing, but those who are not satisfied with abstractions or speculations, who long for an eminently practical science of the Spirit, which would quench their thirst, who feel there is something more to be learnt than seems obtainable from the present religions or philosophies of this world, may feel inclined to study this science, in which case it should be approached as should any other science, namely in a spirit of open-minded investigation, prepare to accept or reject. If a reader thinks there is something herein for which he is seeking, then he should study it carefully, take notes, ask questions, and investigate it as an objective research, not relying on emotion, superstition, or vision, but on facts. One point, however, needs emphasis. Should a reader feel inclined to unravel the mystery of his own life, which is the most important but unfortunately the most ignored aspect of existence, should he be prepared to accept after due consideration a living spiritual teacher and wish for initiation, then he may be assured that, if he follows the few principles described in this book for clean living as laid down by the Master and practices his meditation, he cannot help obtaining at least some proof of the claims made for these signs while still in this earthly life. The more zealous his application to his meditative practices, without neglecting his usual worldly duties, the higher he will go within and the greater will be his transcendental knowledge. Footnote. The term go within is explained in the section entitled How to Approach and Cross the Threshold. End footnote. He will, in fact, be able to prove for himself and, in time to come, be able to say in all sincerity and with increasing humility, not I believe, but I know. Guru Arjan says, Oh, listen to the sublime teachings of the saints. They give out what they have seen with their own eye. Dera Baba Jamal Singh, Punjab, 1948. Guru Tegh Bahadur says, What is the good of running to the forest to find the Lord? He resides within you and pervades all your being, yet is apart. God is within you, as the perfume is in the flower and the image in the mirror. He is deep down at the bottom of your hearts. There he must be sought. In Luke chapter 17, verse 21, it says, Neither shall they say, Lo here, or Lo there, for behold, the kingdom of God is within you. The Inner Voice. Dedicated to the memory of my late beloved master, Baba Sawan Singh Ji Maharaj, who passed away at Bias on the 2nd April 1948. The Message of the Masters. The physical structure of all human beings, within and without, is the same. Their mental and spiritual makeup is also the same. The designer call him God, Allah, Ishwar, Lord, Dieu, God, Jehovah, or any other name who creates all and regulates all, brings redemption and salvation to all in one and the same way. This way is already present within each person and serves all humanity alike. This universal formula is the union of the soul with the Word. Footnote, Word. the dynamic power of God that creates, enlivens, and sustains the universe, and which, in proper conditions, may be experienced by the ear of the soul. End footnote. This way is such that no matter how learned or clever one may be, one cannot discover it. Although it is present in everybody, only a true living master who treads the path to the very end can show it to us. There is no other way. So long as a true spiritual teacher does not give the key, bring us in contact with the word, and help us in meditation, there is no spiritual awakening, no redemption, and no salvation possible. The word is within us, but the key is with the teacher. So long as one does not apply this key, the word remains hidden. This way has not changed with time, nor will it change in the future. The study of the writings of spiritual teachers shows that no matter in what age or country they appeared, they followed and revealed to the world this same spiritual way. To underscore the universality of these teachings, brief quotations from a variety of sources will be presented here. God has bestowed this gift on all human beings alike. All can benefit by it if they choose to do so. This is the message of the Masters, a message of hope and joy for each one of us here on earth. We do not have to wait to experience the truth of it until after death. Tulsi Sahib says, "When we see the reality with our inner eye, only then are we convinced of the correctness of the saints' teachings." The mission of the Masters is purely spiritual. They revivify souls that have figuratively become petrified due to constant connection with mind and matter by bringing them in touch with the vitalizing word. They do not enter into vain discussions. They keep themselves aloof from all religious strife. They do not create new creeds, nor go against, nor condemn any. They come to fulfill and not to destroy. They unite the individual soul with the universal word. The plan of creation. Most of us have asked ourselves, how did we come to this present state of existence? Where have we come from? Where shall we go? To reply to these fundamental questions in a few words is difficult because of our present inability to understand due to our very limited experience of this line of thought. A study of this book, however, should bring to light new horizons for the development of higher faculties that enable us to progress internally. Then one day, we will reach those heights within where our transcendental powers of understanding and consciousness can begin to see and appreciate God's plan of creation and obtain answers to all our questions. There are three main conditions, states or realms of creation: spiritual, mental, and material, each with appropriate forms of life, all created and maintained by the word, which is also called Shabad, Naam, and Kalma. Swamiji says, "The beginning and the end of all creation is Shabad." Guru Amar Das says, "Creation, dissolution, and recreation, all is done by Shabad." Sultan Bahu says, "All 14 realms are within the Kalma. How can the uninitiated comprehend this secret?" In John chapter 1, verse 3, it says, "All things were made by him, the Word, and without him was not anything made that was made." In the purest state of creation, there is only spirit, light, and love. There, the soul is the drop and the Word is the ocean. The soul is in its element. There is the abode of the Supreme Creator and also our true home. Hafiz says, "O Hafiz, the highest spiritual heaven is our ancestral home." Directly below these spiritual realms are the exquisitely beautiful regions of mind in which the soul, in its descent, associates with the mind and puts on the coverings of causal and astral bodies to function in these regions. The mind seemingly becomes more powerful while the soul is veiled. Finally, when the soul, together with the mind and other coverings, reaches the lowest region, the physical limitation is added, a material covering to work in the material world. Here, the soul is untraceable. The mind is perturbed and restless, and being confined within the limits of physical functioning creates an illusory individuality that causes us to forget that we all are one with the Supreme Creator. In the lower states, although there is spirit, the force ruling the conditions of existence is mind. We are here in the realm of a subtle and powerful force that isolates the soul, holds it captive, and prevents it from going back to the spiritual regions to which it belongs. It keeps it confined in the regions of mind and matter. This negative action of mind, as we call it, may seem incredible to some. Nevertheless, the fact remains that the Creator, in His wisdom, arranged that the lower regions of creation should be evolved from and administered by the force of mind, the negative power, as opposed to the positive force of spirit, which is both its complement and source. Although each one of us is a ray of Almighty God the Father, who is universal love, we are, while in these lower states of creation, driven by mind. So strong is the force of mind, so subtle is its working, that very few of us can bring ourselves to realize the Master's statement, so often reiterated, that the greatest enemy in the way of both our spiritual progress and the conscious realization of our oneness with our Heavenly Father is the mind. But again, we may ask, how did we come down to these regions? As stated before, when a soul comes down from its home, the spiritual region, it comes under the influence of mind. This is the way of creation. Once it enters the mind regions and forms association with the mind, it is cut off from its connection with the Word and the spiritual regions. Both soul and mind become, in their descent, progressively subject to the illusion of the senses in order to function in the regions of mind and matter. By desire, we are tempted. Even from our childhood, we are attracted and influenced by our environment. Thereafter, the passions of lust, anger, greed, attachment, and pride further excite our lower instincts. Tangible material things like alcohol, tobacco, and many other stimulants or intoxicants, which bring a temporary physical satisfaction to our senses, plunge us more and more deeply into matter, so that the human in us progressively gives place to the animal. We then may have to assume animal bodies to satisfy our carnal desires, descending lower still, if necessary, even into vegetable forms. From then on, we begin to rise again, pursuing our evolution until eventually we again earn a birth in human form and have the privilege and the ability once more to become conscious of the divinity within us. Human beings are the most highly evolved form of creation. But this opportunity of birth in human form must be utilized to start a relentless struggle against the negative influence of mind in order to progressively free ourselves and to find again the lost path that may bring us once more to the feet of the Creator. Otherwise, we will remain in the claws of mind and as such be obliged to pass again and again to lower forms of life. Here, it may be appropriate to emphasize that although this world is in the lowest region of creation, the Supreme Creator has ordained that man is made in God's image. It is thus only while in the human form and on earth that it is possible for us to undertake steps for our complete evolution and to return by successive stages through the different planes of existence on the spiritual voyage to our immortal home, the source from which we emanated. This evolution even the angels in the astral region cannot begin, for they must still return to this physical plane after they have enjoyed the fruits of their good karma. Footnote: Karma, literally action, the law of cause and effect, whereby every action produces an equivalent reaction. End footnote. Guru Arjan says, "You have attained the incomparable human form. Now is your opportunity to reunite with God. All other pursuits will not avail. In the company of a saint, practice Nam alone." Now comes the next question. How can I go up and away from this cycle of births and deaths? The soul is a misfit in the mind regions and feels uneasy there. No real companionship can exist between two unlikes. In the material regions, the case is still worse. The soul here is altogether out of its element and the mind is in no better condition. Both are under the influence of matter. Both are wandering from place to place in the desolate valley of transmigration and find no resting place. Not one being is really happy in this world. Guru Nanak says, "O Nanak, the whole creation is miserable." Guru Amar Das says, "By returning to one's true home, happiness, my friend, is attained." Material display does not satisfy the mind, and the splendor of the mind regions has no lasting attraction for the soul. The soul, as well as the mind, will remain discontented and restless unless and until they go back to their respective destinations, their true homes, the soul to the spiritual and the mind to the mental regions. Paradoxically, it is usually when conditions are worst that most people begin to look for something beyond. Amidst all the confusion of ideas, theologies and religious theories and disputes, amidst the struggle for material power, the greed of gain and the impression of fictitious happiness that may follow such gain temporarily, some realize the illusion and the follies of this existence. They ask themselves, is there no way out? No one to teach us the truth? Is there no one to whom I can turn instead of being content with what was taught thousands of years ago and misapplied by generations of human interpretations? And that is the moment when help is at hand. For those who have progressed far enough to foresee that there must be someone who knows, there is someone ready to help. For always there is a true spiritual master, one who has mastered his mind, reached the supreme spiritual height, and can take seekers to that height with him. Such masters continually watch over aspirant souls. Just as a person standing on the summit of a hill sees a fire kindled far away or nearby, in the same way a master sees seekers after God and goes to meet them wherever they may be or arranges to guide them to himself. In the Orient, they say, when the disciple is ready, the master appears. And so it is. When we are ready, that is to say when we realize that there is something within us that surpasses mere intellect, something that rejects the illusion of the senses, and when in all humbleness we wish to subordinate self to a higher power, when we become aware that the world is bringing us only deception and disillusionment, when we feel an intense need for perfection and an ardent desire to know the secret of life, then we will meet a master and through his initiation return home, starting this great journey here and now, not in the hereafter. How can we recognize a true master? This is perhaps the most important question we can ever ask throughout our whole existence. For there are many imposters, some deliberately playing on the desires of people earnestly seeking spiritual liberation, some honestly believing themselves masters because they possess a certain amount of power and knowledge. These latter have attained a measure of mental development that gives them a power of leadership, the gift of talking in an enlightened manner, sometimes the power of healing, even clairvoyance, and, in some rare cases, other more miraculous faculties. They create a large following and are generally helpful to society. They may even think quite sincerely that they are highly advanced spiritually. To follow one of these may be beneficial, as many are good people. But no one can take a soul beyond the region to which he has gained access himself. Consequently, we can only be taken out of the regions of mind and matter, rescued from temptation and illusion, and liberated from rebirth by one who, here and now, and while living in human form, goes consciously through the regions of mind and matter back to the spiritual realms and has become one with the Supreme Creator. For only he knows the way, only he has the power and the wisdom required to traverse the higher regions and take others with him. Only he knows which of us are ready to leave this region of correction and travail. Again, the question, how can we recognize such a being? The Master, like other human beings, submits himself to the laws of nature. Born in the usual manner into normal earthly conditions, he lives in accordance with the customs of the country in which he resides. Although he is simple in appearance and never calls attention to himself, nevertheless, in his company, one is soon impressed by the dignity of his bearing, the nobility of his expression, at the same time benign and attractive, radiating peace and joy, indicating a personality apart. Many would pass by him blindly, but the few find themselves arrested and eagerly gazing at him, as though they had found what they had long wished for. A true master may be unmarried or married. He is in the world, but no longer of the world. He is readily approachable by rich and poor, sympathetic and always prepared to answer any questions put to him. He is distinguished, courteous, adapts himself to all grades of society, lives a simple, modest life, and is an example to everyone. Financially, a true master lives on his own income, in no way depending on the support of others. Guru Nanak says, "Never bow down before one who calls himself a guru and spiritual preceptor and goes begging. He who eats what he earns by his honest labour and from his hand gives something in charity, Nanak says, he alone knows the true way." A true master bestows his services and teachings free, just as nature gives us air, light and water as her free gifts. He neither expects nor accepts anything as a reward. He would never consider putting anyone under an obligation. He is truly the giver and never the receiver. To him, all people are alike, irrespective of their race, nationality, creed, or social position. His teaching is universal and common to all. A true master never interferes in the personal affairs of anyone. While we see only the outer appearance of a person, his eye reaches the mind and soul. The masters, though knowing everything, do not lift the veil which the Creator has drawn over our thoughts and emotions. A true master has the highest spiritual knowledge and is able to transmit it. He teaches what he has lived through personal experience of the inner path. In John chapter 3, verses 11 to 12, it says, "Verily, verily, I say unto thee, we speak that we do know, and testify that we have seen, and ye receive not our witness. If I have told you earthly things, and ye believe not, how shall ye believe, if I tell you of heavenly things?" He awakens the soul, the indweller of the body, and gives unfailing guidance to those already initiated. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 26, it says, "For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?" Dadu says, "If a true master is met, all is set right. Taking one aboard, he goes across to the other shore." He is master of his subject when he speaks. He describes the way to come to the presence of the Creator with all the distinguishing features of the path the soul is to follow to reach its true abode. His way is the sound current or the word, and he practices and teaches the same. He is the custodian of the word. He is the word personified and gives the message of the word. The word is the teacher, and the word is the lesson. In John chapter 1, verse 14, it says, "And the word was made flesh and dwelt among us, full of grace and truth." All sages and perfect masters who have reached the spiritual regions beyond the realms of mind and matter have always given the word as their teaching. He knows that the various commandments given in so many religions by their founders are for leading a good, moral, upright life and are the basis for building a spiritual life. Integrity and the sound current go hand in hand. Without morality, there can be no hold on the sound current, and without the practice of the sound current, it is impossible to live by these commandments. Only the practice of the word enables us to conquer the hereditary five foes: lust, anger, greed, attachment, and egoism. Merely to follow moral precepts and lead an upright life is, figuratively speaking, like putting ashes on the fire. It is not extinguished. When the ashes are blown away by the force of karmic wind, the fire is rekindled, and we are again a victim of the relentless foes. The practice of the word is like putting water on the fire, which is thus quenched forever. A master does not perform outer miracles for show. Instead, the protection and guidance that disciples receive from the master, the way he frees the soul within from the clutches of mind and brings it in contact with the Word and the Supreme Being, are the true miracles. A true master is here among us for guidance. In his radiant form, he is within the disciple to accompany him on the way and is there without fail at the time of the disciple's departure from this perishable world. Footnote: radiant form, the inner form of the master, which is manifested from the word and seen by the disciple in the inner regions. End footnote. The temple of God. Where is the laboratory in which this science of the masters is to be studied? It is in the human body, the temple of God. To the person whose inner eye is yet closed, temples, churches, synagogues and mosques made of bricks, stone and mortar are the places of worship. Tulsi Sahib says, "How sad it is that to man-made temples and mosques the inhabitants of the natural mosques go just to suffer pain. To the awakened soul, the true temple is the body in which it lives and finds the Lord. We are told in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 16, "For ye are the temple of the living God." We are enjoined to seek the kingdom of heaven within us, to listen there to God's voice, the sound current, His word. In Janamsakhi, it says, "The voice of God resounds from the vault of the temple, but the sleepy world hears not. O multitude, who remain deaf to His calling, behold the happiness of the few spiritually awakened, who listen to the voice of the Lord and are joined to Him." Bu Ali Qalandar, a Muslim saint, says, "The Beloved resides within you, O ignorant one, and you are searching for Him outside from place to place." There is little doubt that the true meaning of these vital sayings is not generally understood. Our body is a wonderful house. It is the epitome of all creation. Man is the microcosm and the universe is the macrocosm. They are interrelated. The macrocosm is reached and studied through the microcosm. Bipa says, "Whatever is in the universe is also in the body. Whatsoever one seeks in the body, one will find." When the threshold of the temple is crossed, the soul finds itself in new and exceedingly attractive worlds. Within is the transcendental knowledge and the divine treasure of the Word. Within is the living God with all that He has created. How to approach and cross the threshold? How can we go within the temple? This objective we can achieve by meditation and connecting ourselves with the sound current, the Word, which is reverberating in every human frame. True meditation, as taught by the Masters, develops the ability to detach oneself from the pleasures, distractions, and worries of this world, allowing one to move towards higher states of consciousness. To accomplish this, it is necessary to cross the threshold and enter one's own temple, the human body. This is done by withdrawing the scattered attention from the external world and holding it in the center of consciousness in the forehead, known as the single eye or third eye, Tisra Dil. The attention is withdrawn through the practice of Simran, a natural human habit. Then the attention gradually vacates the body, leaving it senseless, occupies the eye center and, in a superconscious state, crosses the threshold and enters the temple within. The purpose of Simran is to take the disciple that far and no further. Footnote: Simran, repetition, remembrance, the first part of the meditational practice taught by the saints, imparted to the disciple at the time of initiation. End footnote. Rumi says, "You are such that besides this physical body, you have another, astral body. Do not therefore be afraid of getting out of the mortal frame." Rumi also says, "When you are freed from this body, you will enter into a new world without any effort." This withdrawal of attention from the external world is the same process as occurs at the time of physical death, except that the attention, always under the conscious control of the practitioner, returns to the body at the end of the period of practice. It is therefore referred to as dying while living. Hadith says, "Die before your death." Guru Nanak says, "Go while alive to the place where you are to go after death." In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 31, it says, I die daily. Here, the attention finds itself in a new world, and in the presence of the radiant form of the Master, who takes his seat at the disciples' eye center at the time of initiation. In this temple, disciples begin to realize the grace, the glory, and the power of the Master. Here, they begin not just to believe, but to know and see with the inner eye. All people are normally engaged in the Simran of their routine work and revolve in their minds words and ideas connected with their work. The Masters utilize this habit, but simply change the subject matter, giving instead holy names connected with the way within. The technique of Simran is fully explained at the time of initiation. It is a perfectly natural method, simple and efficient, and involves absolutely no danger of any kind. Practices such as the control of the breath or repeating words with its inhalation and exhalation have no place in this spiritual technique. This method may take months, years, or even a whole life, depending essentially on one's efforts and one's place on the ladder of spiritual evolution. It can be practiced at home and in all circumstances, no matter where our destiny has placed us. It is not necessary to seek seclusion in monasteries, take refuge in caves, or lead the life of an ascetic. It involves no expense whatever and can be practiced by anyone, rich or poor, high or low, and at any age, irrespective of creed, colour or race. It is thus more suited to our times than any other method. If we accept this possibility and reflect over the matter, we will see that a vast field of research is opened to us. We begin to understand ourselves and our fellow creatures better and to appreciate that we are all children of the same Lord and therefore none of us can sit in judgment on others. There is little to be proud of in our selfish lives and we grow to realize the value of a humble and contrite heart. The sound current or the word. All religious scriptures mention the sound current or the word, but unfortunately, their followers are unaware of it. Hindus call it the celestial voice, Akashvani, that which can be heard, Shruti, unstruck divine melody, Anhad Shabad. The Chandogya and Manduk Upanishad name it the celestial song, Udgit. In the Adi Granth, it has been expressed as name, naam, word, bani, melody, ton, truth, such, ceaseless eternal sound, anhad shabad, guru's word, gurbani, sound, shabad, etc. Muslims call it word, kalma, voice of God, kalame ilahi, heavenly sound, Nidai Asmani, great name, Ism-e-Azam, or king of repetitions, Sultan ul-Azkar. Ancient Greek mystics referred to it as word, logos. Socrates spoke of an inner sound that transported him to realms transcendent and divine. Zoroaster spoke of it as Sarosha. Theophysists enumerate some of the sounds that are heard within and call them the voice of the silence. It has been termed the pure white music. In John chapter 1, verse 1, it says, In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word is the Holy Spirit, and without consciously coming in contact with it, there is no possibility of real spiritual progress. In Isaiah chapter 40, verse 8, it says, "The grass withereth, the flower fadeth, but the word of our God shall stand forever." The word is the fundamental principle of all the religions. The difference lies in the extent to which their adepts ascended up the sound current or the word. When a master initiates a soul, he brings to that soul, at that moment, the ability to become conscious of this sound current. During all the millions of years we have been wandering around, lost and blind, we have forgotten our true selves and our Maker. We have lost the way, the sound current. Now it will be different. We are to meet our Creator through the sound current which keeps creation in being. Shah Niaz says, "A sound is vibrating in the whole of creation. When you open your inner ear, you will hear a continuous sound, which will lead you across all limitations of mind and matter. My Beloved is speaking to you all the time. Alas, you do not hear His voice." When we first hear this wonderful sound, it is very soft, but gradually it amplifies in volume, tone, and character. In reality, our finer senses develop and we thereby appreciate it better. So long as the mind remains attached to the body and its desires, it cannot grasp the word. It must be again emphasized that without the conscious appreciation of this current, you can make no real spiritual progress, and this word or sound current cannot be discovered until you are initiated into it by a spiritual master, no matter how clever and intelligent you may be. The word is the only means to take us across the ocean of mind and matter into spiritual realms. Without a master, there is no contact with the sound current. And without the sound current, there is no salvation. This is the sum of the entire philosophy of the saints. Conditions for initiation. Before a master gives initiation, the applicant must agree to live by certain principles that are essential for spiritual progress. 1. To lead a morally upright life. In Matthew chapter 5, verse 8, it says, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." In Proverbs chapter 11, verse 3, it says, "The integrity of the upright shall guide them." Upright living is the necessary foundation for any spiritual advancement. All religions give detailed laws or rules governing moral conduct. This science offers only a few explicit guidelines, for as one progresses spiritually, one's conscience becomes more refined, heightening moral discrimination from within. These guidelines include earning an honest living, not unnecessarily hurting the feelings of any living being, engaging in controlled sexual activity exclusively with one's lawful spouse, or remaining celibate if unmarried. 2. To abstain from eating any meat, fish, eggs, or foods that contain them. These dietary conditions are imposed for the disciples' benefit. Life subsists on life on this plane. Saints teach us to regulate our lives to support our spiritual progress. The higher the form of life taken, the greater the adverse karma that has to be paid off. Flesh eating entails taking higher life and hardens the mind. It works against spiritual progress. Eggs, when fertile, are alive, and even when infertile, are a food that excites animal instincts. But humans have to eat in order to live. A good nourishing diet that provides proteins, fats, carbohydrates, minerals and vitamins, gives ample variations and suits all tastes, can be made from a judicious combination of cereals, legumes, vegetables, fruits, nuts, sugars, vegetable oils and dairy products. Tea, coffee and chocolate may be used in moderate quantity. This diet entails taking only the lowest forms of life. Even then, the karmic law applies. But as mind in the vegetable kingdom is dormant, the karma incurred is minimal and the daily practice of the word compensates for the karmic effects. 3. To abstain from alcoholic drinks and other intoxicants. Intoxicants, besides being deleterious to health, distort one's power of judgment or sense of discrimination between right and wrong and weaken self-control, without which there can be no progress in meditation. 4. After initiation, to devote 2.5 hours daily to the practice of meditation. The master asks and expects every disciple to give a tenth of his or her time to the practice of meditation, remembering that meditation is the most important thing and alone stands to our credit on the day when we will be judged. Only through meditation can we go in and leave the attachments and desires of this world. Sultan Bahu says, "Be brave and swim across the ocean of love, plunging straight into its fierce waves, its deadly whirlpools. And don't be frightened at the sight of the dense forests or threatening inner wastelands on your way to the country of love. Only when you sacrifice your life in your love for God will you deserve the name Fakir, O Bahu." And here it is necessary to emphasize that if we wish to know our Maker, the purpose for which we are given human birth, we must pay off our remaining karma, overcome the temptations of our mind, and learn to know ourselves. This is accomplished by following the instructions given by a perfect master. After initiation, he is always with us, watching us, and we can turn to him for help and guidance. Karma. Karma in Sanskrit means doing, action and reaction, cause and effect, reaping what was sown before, and harvesting hereafter what we sow now. The study of this science reveals that the doctrines of karma and reincarnation are based on facts, that the experiences of one life condition the succeeding one, although subconsciously, that the circumstances under which we live now, whether apparently good or bad, are only the consequences of our own doings in the past. That each life on this or similar planes offers us an opportunity to direct our steps toward our emancipation. It may be argued that this is fatalism, but nothing is farther from the truth. Fatalism implies sitting down and doing nothing, whereas karma, as stated above, means to do. It is our own efforts and desires that determine what we are and what we become. Hence, there is no room here for dejection and fatalism. A correct appreciation of karma would show us that each condition brought about by a past action is an opportunity to learn from experience, to overcome weaknesses, and to learn to be humble even if our karma has placed us in favourable circumstances. To know that a wrong action in this life necessitates paying for it later should help us to avoid indulging anew in this folly. Our diverse actions have so complicated our lives and weakened and confused our intellect that to reach any appreciation of our present standing of its hows and whys is almost impossible. Deep is the mystery of karma. Only awakened and enlightened souls are able to see the plan. Karma is like the sowing of seed. Before placing it in the soil, the farmer has the choice to select the seed he will sow, but having planted it, there is no option left to him. He must in due time reap what he has sown and live until the next season on the harvest he has gathered. Similar is the tale of the karmic seed. Before performing an action, we have a choice in our decision, but the result of our actions will be the crop that we must reap in a future life. Masters explain that there are three main categories of karma: fate, new, and reserve. Some of our past actions come with us as fate. They determine the framework of our lives, provide our environments, and form our hopes and desires. Despite ourselves, but unmistakably, we are drawn to activities whereby we experience the consequences of our doings. While we are working out our destiny, which we have to undergo, we are also determining the direction of our future lives by our actions and desires in the present life. We are thus doing two kinds of actions: those that work through our present destiny and those that make our future new karmas. These two are so intermingled and overlapping that it would seem difficult to distinguish which is which. Yet with some awakening, this distinction becomes possible. There is yet another class of karma that can also be illustrated from the working of the farmer. He lives, as said before, on the crop that he has gathered. If there is a surplus, he puts that aside for use in the future to meet his requirements in lean years. The same applies to our karma. Some of the new karma accumulated at the end of each life is set aside and kept in reserve. If we have not created any new karma in this life, though this is almost an impossibility, this reserve will be drawn upon after we have worked out the fate karma from the present life. Such reserve karma, to be drawn upon to meet any karmic insufficiency, has been arranged by the negative power, to keep the soul confined to these regions, as there cannot be any rebirth without some karma to be worked out. This is a very brief description of karma, which can help us realize the extreme complexity of its working. Karma forms a vast, intricate trap in which all forms of creation are caught and from which they can find no way of escape. All the methods that people use to free themselves are of no avail. They read scriptures, study philosophy, sing hymns, perform religious ceremonies, worship sacred images and idols, attend churches, hear sermons, say prayers, go on pilgrimages, keep fasts, give alms, follow codes of morality, do charitable deeds, and think that by these ways they will attain salvation. These may be good acts and useful to a point, but they do not disentangle and take the soul out from the sphere of karma. Such devotees indeed get their reward, but to receive it, they must come back again to the physical plane. Even if they obtain access to astral or mental regions for the enjoyment of those rewards, they have to come back and be born on this earth after the period of enjoyment is over. Swamiji says, "Only a perfect master and Shabad are your two real friends. Give your heart to them and throw out all else from it." Both the master and Shabad represent the positive power and reach out to us from the spiritual regions to release our souls from this karmic trap. If we contact them, develop love for them, and make ourselves worthy to follow them, then we shall be able to cross the sphere of karma in their company and thus break out of the trap. When seekers have been accepted by a master and receive initiation from him, they should regard their physical and mental faculties as a trust from the master and act accordingly. This way, their energies will not be misapplied. All the actions they perform will be in the name of the master. This will give them, by and by, the power of acting in a detached manner. If the disciples give time regularly to Simran and the hearing of the sound current, their love for the master and the word will develop. Their scattered attention will then be concentrated and directed inward, thereby giving them increased powers of working without attachment. So while doing, they will not be bound by their actions and the fruits thereof. They perform karma but are not bound by it. In other words, the seeds they are sowing will not germinate and they will not have to reap the crop. By the time they have crossed the span of life, they will have worked out their destiny, fate karma, and their increased powers will have helped them to undergo their fate cheerfully. As the karmic account is transferred from the accountant, the negative power, to the master at the time of initiation, the connection with the accountant is cut off. Now the reserve karma no longer binds the disciples to the creation. When the master finds that the disciples have worked out their destiny and have no worldly desires, they need not return to this world. The master then places them in a suitable environment on the way inside, where they have the privilege of constant contact with the sound current, which nullifies the reserve karma and enables them to proceed on their homeward journey. The proof. It was stated at the beginning of this small book that the science under review is freely open to proof by each soul while in human form. Several of these proofs have been indicated, namely, the ability to go within and move up to higher planes during meditation, the ability to experience the sound current and to develop that capacity to an unlimited degree. But there is a greater proof, one that is almost overwhelming in its joy. When disciples have passed the threshold, pierced the veil, and risen to some degree, they reach the astral region, where they meet the Master in his radiant form. The same living Master who has taken them to himself with the promise of guiding them step by step up to the Creator, the one whom they can see and talk to and write to in this world, the one whom they can go to with the worries and difficulties of their lives, is in radiant form waiting to receive them at the beginning of the inward journey. Thereafter, the radiant form never leaves them for one moment until he has completed his task of bringing those disciples to the presence of their Father in the highest heaven. Therefore, for the disciples of a perfect master, there is no fear of death, for when they have pierced the veil and risen to the first region, they have, in effect, transcended death. There is one more wonderful fact about a true master. When the disciples have no more worldly desires, have paid off their karmic debts, and are ready to depart from this world, the master then comes in his radiant form and takes them away finally to place them in the region best suited to their spiritual progress. For the disciples, there is no necessity to return to this world. Without further rebirth, they will pursue their spiritual ascension accompanied by the Master, ever present to lead them to the final goal. Think for a moment what this means. When one follows a true Master, one is never again lonely. There is a friend, not only for life but for eternity, an incomparable friend who will never leave the disciple even if the disciple may deny him, a friend whose unselfish love transcends that of any mortal being. Guru Arjan says, "Break thou with false friends and seek a perfect master. The former part company in this very life, but the latter does not leave us even after death." Let us think very deeply over these facts. Think, too, where we have arrived. We have reached a stage when we can say that the realization of the supreme power, the power of love, is within our reach if we really wish for it. The church bells call their worshippers on Sunday only, but the bell of the temple within tolls day and night without cessation, but, alas, the world heeds not. Questions and answers. Question. If I wish to follow a master, should I give up my religion? Answer. No. When a master initiates you, he puts you in touch with the word or sound current and teaches you the method of becoming attuned to it. Anybody of any religion can practice this meditation technique. The same fundamental or vital truths are found within all the major religions. By following the example of Christ or any other spiritual master, we have taken a step forward towards salvation. Their teachings are true. But religions in themselves are human creations, and often far from the original teaching, which cannot be verified from reliable sources because the teacher is no longer present for us to do so. Religious doctrines are sometimes incompatible with our own convictions and always open to individual interpretations. Therefore, when we wish to find out things for ourselves, instead of accepting or rejecting the orthodox teaching of the religion in which we were brought up, we should try to find someone who has real knowledge. That someone must be a true living master, because he is the one who speaks from personal experience, and he will enable us to experience the truths of which the religions speak. Question. How can I follow Christ or any other master of the past and accept a living master? Answer. By accepting a living master, you are not thereby denying Christ or any other spiritual master of the past, but are rather following what they have actually taught. The teachings of the masters do not change with time. They are the same in the past, present, and future. To make contact with their students and to give them the word, it is necessary for the teacher to adopt the physical form. Masters who played their part long ago and left the stage cannot do this. Only a living master in human form can do it. Can a schoolmaster who died 100 years ago teach our children? Can a patient wait for the coming of Hippocrates, the founder of medicine who passed away ages ago? Just as these are impossibilities, so to expect salvation through teachers who left the world stage long ago is also an impossibility. Question. If, in spite of my weaknesses and my faults, I am accepted by a master and he initiates me, with all the advantages claimed for such initiation, why do much more worthy people not have the privilege of such acceptance? Answer. There are many fine souls in the world doing good work and living noble lives, but they are content with their lot, their religion, and their outlook. If we want initiation from a living master, we must ask for it and seek it ourselves. Those who do not do so are either unaware of the need or are not desirous of it. Question. The present master lives in India. Is there no other true master? And why is there not also one living in the West? If I wish for initiation, how can I receive it? Answer. There have been more than one master at a time, but this is not always the case. Masters reside in a country where souls who are ready for initiation are mostly placed. India is recognized as a land of mysticism, and conditions are favorable there for leading a spiritual life. Concerning the presence of a true master today in the West, we have no knowledge of any. There may be, but we speak here of the one we have met. We can contact his representatives in various parts of the world. Question. May I read and study the books concerning this science and ask questions without any obligation? Answer. Yes, gladly and without obligation. We are all seekers after truth and should be glad to help one another. Question. If I ask for initiation, what about my family? Answer. Our family consists of a group of individual souls, each one following its way according to its own destiny. Spiritual research is a personal matter in which there should be no coercion or dogmatism, neither in society nor in private life. Question. What must I do to prepare myself for initiation, and is there a probationary period? Answer. The master is the only one who can assess a soul's readiness for initiation, irrespective of how the soul may have appeared to live in this life. In order to enable his representatives to refer each individual case to him for initiation, the master asks that anyone seeking it should follow the conditions laid down in conditions for initiation, sufficiently long to prove to himself that he is prepared to follow these conditions for the rest of his life. Question. If I try meditation and begin to go inside, how do I know that I am not mistaken, misled, or in any danger, and that I am certain of returning to my body in a normal state? Answer. It is not advisable to try to go inside without the guidance of a perfect master. But when we come to a true spiritual master, we never need fear. He gives precise instructions as to what is to be followed and what is to be avoided. He is watching us the whole time, whether we are aware of it or not, and practical proofs of his constant protection are immediately forthcoming at the time of need. In this practice, one goes in consciously and returns at will back into the body without any harm or danger. Question. If I feel inclined to study this science and I am already following a master, would I be justified in leaving him? Answer. If your master is what he professes to be, he will welcome your desire to search and, if you are able to prove that you have found a higher philosophy than the one he knows about, he would be glad to let you study it. Masters are very liberal-minded. They do not stand in the way of anybody's freedom of thought and action. Your relations with your master should remain very cordial. Question. I understand from the teachings that we are to merge ourselves with the infinite creator. Does this imply losing one's individuality? Answer. Our so-called individuality is an illusion brought about by the imprisonment of ourself in a temporary material body hampered by the ego. By holding to our illusory individuality, we are really isolating ourselves from the universal power and real self. In the process whereby the soul merges itself with the infinite, there need be no fear of the loss of individuality. The drop always gains by merging in the ocean because it thereby becomes the ocean. End of The Inner Voice by C.W. Sanders. Print copyright 1948 and 2002, and audio recording copyright 2026, Radha Swami Satsang Bias, all rights reserved.